Right now, I'm just asking what you think. We've been through this. I'm keeping the case. There's no issue. It hits pretty close to home, Andy. Your son might be in danger. If he'd been unlucky enough to be walking through that park at the wrong time... LeJudas said, Maybe your judgment is clouded just a little. I mean, if you're being fair, if you stop and think about it objectively... Clouded how? Does it make you emotional? No. Are you angry, Andy? Do I look angry? I counted out the words one by one. Yeah, you do, a little, or maybe just offensive. But you shouldn't be. We're all on the same side here. Hey, it's perfectly natural to be emotional. If my son was involved, Neil, are you actually questioning my integrity or just my competence? Neither. I'm questioning your objectivity. Lynn, does he speak for you? Are you believing this bullshit? She frowned. My antennae are up, to be honest. Your antennae? Come on, what does that mean? I'm uneasy. LeJudas. It's the appearance, Andy, the appearance of objectivity. Nobody's saying you actually... Look, just fuck off, Neil, okay? This doesn't concern you. Excuse me? Just let me run my case. I don't give a rat's ass about the appearance. The case is going slow because that's the way it's going, not because I'm dragging my feet. I'm not going to be stampeded into indicting someone just to make it look good. I thought I taught you better than that. You taught me I should push every case as hard as I could. I am pushing as hard as I can. Why haven't you interviewed the kids? It's been 5 days already. You know damn well why, because this isn't Boston, Neil, it's Newton. Every frickin' detail has to be negotiated. Which kids we can talk to, where we talk to them, what we can ask, who has to be present. This isn't Dorchester High. Half the parents in this school are lawyers. Relax, Andy. No one's accusing you of anything. The problem is how it will be perceived. From the outside, it might look like you're ignoring the obvious. Meaning what? The students. Have you considered that the killer might be a student? You've told me 1,000 times, haven't you? Follow the evidence wherever it leads. There's no evidence to suggest it's a student. None. If there were, I'd follow it. You can't follow it if you won't look for it. This was an aha moment. I finally got it. The time had come, as I always knew it would. I was the one immediately above Neil on the ladder. Now he would target me the way he had so many others. I made a wry smile. Neil, what is it you're after? Is it the case? You want it? You can have it. Or is it my job? What the hell, you can have that too. But it'd be easier for everyone if you'd just come out and say it. I don't want anything, Andy. I just want to see things come out right. Lynn, are you taking me off the case or are you going to back me? She gave me a warm look but an indirect answer. When have I ever not backed you? I nodded, accepting the truth of this. I put on a resolute mask and declared a fresh start. Look, the school just reopened today. The kids are all back. We have the student interviews this afternoon. Something good is going to happen soon. Good, Canavan said. Let's hope so. But LeJudas chipped in. Who's going to interview your son? I don't know. Not you, I hope. Not me. Paul Duffy, probably. Who decided that? Me. That's the way it works, Neil. I decide. And if there's a mistake, it'll be me standing in front of the jury to take the hit. He gave Canavan a look. See, I told you he won't listen. Which she met with a neutral expression. Chapter 5. Everyone Knows You Did It. The student interviews began right after school. For the kids, it had been a long day filled with class meetings and grief counseling. CPAC detectives in plain clothes had gone from classroom to classroom, encouraging kids to share tips with the investigators, anonymously if necessary. The kids stared back dully. The McCormick was a middle school, which in this town meant it covered grades 6 through 8. The building was an arrangement of plain rectangular boxes. Inside, the walls were painted thick with many layers of teal. Lori grew up in Newton and went to McCormick in the 1970s. She said the school had hardly changed, except for the illusion, as she walked down the halls, that the whole structure had shrunk. As I had told Canavan, these interviews were a contentious subject. At first, the school principal flatly refused to allow us to storm in and talk to any kid we pleased. Had the crime happened in another place, in the herb rather than the suburb, we would not have bothered to ask permission. Here, the school board and even the mayor intervened directly with Lynn Canavan to slow us down. In the end, we were allowed to talk to the kids on school grounds, but only on certain conditions. Kids who were not in Ben Rifkin's homeroom were off limits unless we had a specific reason to believe they might know something. Any student could have a parent and/or lawyer present and could end the interview at any time for any reason or no reason. Most of this was easy to concede. They were entitled to a lot of it anyway. The real point of stipulating so many rules was to send the cops a message. Treat these kids with kid gloves. Which was fine, but precious time was lost while we diddled around negotiating. At 2 o'clock, Paul and I commandeered the principal's office, and together we interviewed the highest priority witnesses. The victim's close friends, a few kids who were known to walk to school through Cold Spring Park, and those who specifically requested to speak with the investigators. 2 dozen interviews were scheduled for the two of us. Other CPAC detectives would conduct interviews at the same time. Most we expected to be brief and yield nothing. We were trawling, dragging our net along the sea bottom, hoping. But something odd happened. After just 3 or 4 interviews, Paul and I had the distinct impression we were being stonewalled. At first we thought we were seeing the usual repertoire of adolescent tics and evasions, the shrugs and you-knows and whatevers, the wandering eyes. We were both fathers. We knew that walling out adults was what all teenagers did. It was the whole point of these behaviors. In itself, there was nothing suspicious about it. But as the interviews went on, we realized something more brazen and purposeful was going on. The kids' answers went too far. They were not content to say they knew nothing about the murder. They denied even knowing the victim. Ben Rifkin seemed to have had no friends at all, only acquaintances. Other kids never spoke to him, had no idea who did. These were transparent lies. Ben had not been unpopular. We already knew who most of Ben's friends were. It was a betrayal, I thought, for his buddies to disown him so quickly and completely. Worse, the 8th graders at the McCormick were not especially competent liars. Some of them, the more shameless ones, seemed to believe that the way to pass off a lie convincingly was to oversell it. So when they got ready to tell a particularly tall one, they would stop all the foot shuffling and you-knows and deliver the lie with maximum conviction. It was as if they had read a manual on behaviors associated with honesty, eye contact, firm voice, and were determined to display them all at once like peacocks fanning their tail feathers. The effect was to reverse the behavior patterns you might expect to see in adults. The teens seemed evasive when honest and direct when lying. But their shifting manner set off alarm bells just the same. The other kids, the majority, were too self-conscious to begin with, and lying only made them more so. They were tentative. The truth inside them made them squirm. This obviously did not work either. I could have told them, of course, that a virtuoso liar slips the false statement in among the true ones without a flutter of any kind, like a magician slipping the bent card into the middle of the deck. I've had an education in virtuosic lying, believe me. Paul and I began to exchange suspicious glances. The pace of the interviews slowed as we challenged some of the more obvious lies. Between interviews, Paul joked about a code of silence. "These kids are like Sicilians," he said. Neither of us said what we were truly thinking. There is a plummeting feeling, as if the floor has fallen away beneath you. It is the happy vertigo you feel when a case opens up and lets you in. Apparently we had been wrong. There was no other way to say it. We had considered the possibility that a fellow student was involved, but we had discounted it. There was no evidence pointing that way. No sullen outcasts among the students, no sloppy schoolboy trail of evidence to follow. Nor was there an apparent motive, no grandiose adolescent fantasies of outlaw glory, no damaged, bullied kids out for revenge, no petty classroom feud, nothing. Now, neither of us had to say it. That vertiginous feeling was the thought. These kids knew something. A girl sloped into the office and dropped into the chair opposite us. Then, with great effort, she refused to acknowledge us. Sarah Grohl? Paul said.
Yes.
I'm Lieutenant Detective Paul Duffy. I'm with the state police. This here is Andrew Barber. He's the assistant district attorney in charge of this case.
I know.
She looked up at me finally.
You're Jacob Barber's dad.
Yes, you're the sweatshirt girl from this morning. She smiled shyly. Sorry, I should have remembered you. I'm having a tough day, Sarah.
Yeah, why's that?
Nobody wants to talk to us.
Now, why is that? You have any idea?
You're cops. That's it?
Sure.
She made a face. Duh. I waited a moment, hoping for more. The girl returned a look of exquisite boredom. Are you a friend of Jacob's? She looked down, considered, shrugged.
I guess so.
How come I haven't heard your name?
Ask Jacob.
He doesn't tell me anything. I have to ask you.
We know each other. We're not like friends, Jacob and me. We just know each other.
How about Ben Rifkin? Did you know him?
Same. I knew him, but I didn't really know him.
Did you like him?
He was okay.
Just okay?
He was a good kid, I guess. Like I said, we weren't really close.
Okay, so I'll stop asking stupid questions. Why don't you just tell us, Sarah, anything at all that might help us, anything you think we ought to know? She shifted in her seat.
I don't really know what you... I don't know what to tell you.
Well, tell me about this place, this school. Start with that. Tell me something about McCormick that I don't know. What's it like to go to school here? What's funny about this place? What's strange about it? No response.
Sarah, we want to help, you know, but we need some of you kids to help us.
She shifted around in her seat. You owe that much to Ben, don't you think, if he was your friend?
I don't know. I don't have anything to say, I guess. I don't know anything.
Sarah, whoever did this, he's still out there. You know that, don't you? If you can help, then you have a responsibility, a real responsibility. Otherwise, the same thing is going to happen again to some other kid. Then it would be on you. If you didn't do everything, absolutely everything you could, to make it stop, then the next one would be on you, wouldn't it? How would that make you feel?
You're trying to guilt me. It won't work. My mom does that, too.
I'm not trying to guilt you. I'm just telling you the truth. No response. Bang. Duffy smacked the table with his open palm. Some papers drifted with the breeze he created.
Jesus, this is bullshit, Andy. Just put a subpoena on these kids already, would you? Put them in the grand jury, swear them in, and if they don't want to say anything, just lock them up for contempt. This is a waste of time, for Christ's sake.
The girl's eyes dilated. Duffy took his cell phone from a holster on his belt and looked at it, though it had not rung. I have to make a call, he announced. I'll be right back. And out he marched. The kid said,
Is he supposed to be the bad cop?
Yeah.
He's not very good at it.
You jumped. I saw you.
Only 'cause he startled me. He banged the table.
He's right, you know. If you kids don't start helping us out, we'll have to do this another way.
I thought we didn't have to say anything if we didn't want to.
That's true today. Tomorrow, maybe not. She thought it over. Sarah, it's true what you said before. I'm a DA. But I'm also a dad, okay? So I'm not going to just let this thing go. Because I keep thinking of Ben Rifkin's dad. I keep thinking of how he must be feeling. Can you even imagine how your mom or dad would feel if this happened to you? How devastated they'd be?
They're split up. My dad's out of the picture. I live with my mom.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's no big deal.
Well, Sarah, look, you're all our kids, you know? All you kids in Jacob's class, even the ones I don't know, I care about. All of us parents feel that way. She rolled her eyes.
You don't believe that?
No, you don't even know me. That's true. Still, I care what happens to you just the same. I care about this school, this town. I'm not going to just let this happen. This isn't going away, you understand that?
Is anyone talking to Jacob?
You mean my son, Jacob?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Why do you say that?
No reason.
There must be a reason. What is it, Sarah? The girl studied her lap.
The cop who came to our class said we could tell you things anonymously?
That's right. There's a tip line.
How do we know you won't try to, like, figure out who gave a tip?
I mean, that's something you'd want to know, right? Who said something?
Sarah, come on. What is it you want to say?
How do we know it will stay anonymous?
You just have to trust us, I guess.
Trust who? You?
Me? Detective Duffy? There's a lot of people working on this case.
What if I just...
She looked up. Look, I'm not going to lie to you, Sarah. If you tell me something here, it's not anonymous. My job is to catch the guy who did this, but it's also to try him in court, and for that I'll need witnesses. I'd be lying if I told you any different. I'm trying to be honest with you here.
Okay.
She considered.
I really don't know anything.
You sure about that?
Yes.
I looked her in the eye just a moment to let her know I wasn't fooled. Then I accepted her lie. I pulled a business card from my wallet. This is my card. I'm going to write my cell phone number on the back. My personal email, too. I slid the card across the desk. You can contact me anytime, okay? Anytime. And I'll do what I can to look out for you.
Okay.
She took the card and stood up. She looked down at her hands, at her fingers. Her fingertips were stained with black ink, imperfectly wiped off. All the students at the school were being fingerprinted that day, voluntarily, though there were jokes about the implications of refusing. Sarah frowned at the ink stains, then crossed her arms to hide them, and in that awkward posture she said,
"Hey, can I ask you something, Mr. Barber? Are you ever the bad cop?"
"No, never."
"Why not?"
"It's just not me, I guess."
"So how do you do your job, then?"
"I have a mean streak, deep down, trust me."
"You just hide it?"
"I just hide it." That night, before 11, I was alone in the kitchen using my laptop computer, which I had set up on the kitchen counter. I was cleaning up some odd bits of work, answering emails mostly. A new message arrived in my inbox. The subject line read, "Shouted, Re, Ben Rifkin, read me." It was from a Gmail address, tylerdurden982@gmail.com. The timestamp read 10:54:27 p.m. The message contained a single line, a hyperlink. "Look here." I clicked the link. The link took me to a Facebook group called Friends of Ben Rifkin. The Facebook group was new. It could not have been established more than 4 days before. The day of the murder, CPAC had looked at Facebook and it was not there. We had found the dead boy's personal Facebook page. Almost every kid at the McCormick was on Facebook. But Ben's page contained no hints about the murder. For what it was worth, in his profile, he had been keen to present himself as a free spirit. "Ben Rifkin is out boarding. Networks, McCormick Middle School, 07, Newton, Massachusetts. Sex, male. Interested in, women. Relationship status, single. Birthday, December 3rd, 1992. Political views, Vulcan. Religious views, heathen." The rest was the usual clutter of digital junk. YouTube videos, games, pictures, a stream of vapid, gossipy messages. Relatively speaking, though, Ben had not been an especially heavy user of Facebook. Much of the activity on his page happened after he was murdered, when messages from Ben's classmates continued to accumulate in a ghostly way until the page was removed at his parents' request. The new tribute page apparently was opened in response to give kids a place to go on posting messages about the murder. The title, Friends of Ben Rifkin, seemed to use friends in the Facebook sense. It was open to anyone in the McCormick class of 2007, whether or not they had actually been Ben's friend. At the top of the page was a small photo of Ben, the same one he had used on his personal page. Presumably, it had been cut and pasted from the dead boy's old page by whoever launched this group. The picture showed Ben smiling, shirtless, apparently on a beach. The sand and ocean were visible behind him. He was making a hang-loose gesture with his right hand. Down the right side of the page, there was a panel called The Wall, filled with messages in reverse chronological order. Jenna Lind, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 9:02 p.m. on April 17, 2007, "I miss you, Ben. I remember our talks. I love you forever. I love you. I love you.
Krista Dufresne, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 8:43 p.m. on April 17, 2007.
This is the cruelest thing whoever did this. I will never forget you, Ben. I think about you every day.
It is important to note that in 2007, Facebook was still largely a kid's paradise. Its explosive growth among adults happened in the following couple of years. That was the case in our circle, at least. Most of the parents at the McCormick School looked at Facebook now and then to monitor what their kids were up to, but that was about it. A few of our friends joined, but they rarely used it. There were not enough other parents there yet to make it worthwhile. Personally, I had no idea what Jacob and his friends saw on Facebook. I could not grasp why all this information churning was so compelling. The only explanation, it seemed to me, was that Facebook was where kids went to be away from adults, their secret place where they strutted and flirted and goofed around with the bravado they could never muster in person in the school cafeteria. Jacob certainly was much more clever and assertive online than in person, as many shy kids are. Lori and I saw the danger in allowing Jacob to carry on like this in secret. We insisted he give us his password so we could check up on him. But honestly, Lori was the only one who ever looked at Jacob's Facebook page. To me, the kid's online conversation was even less interesting than the offline version. If I ever looked at Facebook back then, it was because the face in question was in one of my case files. Was I a neglectful parent? In hindsight, obviously yes. But then we all were, all the parents at Jacob's school. We did not know the stakes were so high. There were already several hundred messages on the Friends of Ben Rifkin page. Emily Saltzman, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 10:12 p.m. on April 16, 2007,
I am still totally wigged. Who did this? Why did you do it? Why? What was the point? What did you get out of it? This is just so sick.
Alex Curzon, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 1:14 p.m. on April 16, 2007,
at Cold Spring Park now. Yellow tape still up. Nothing to see, though. No cops.
The messages went on like this, unguarded, confessional. The web created an illusion of intimacy, a byproduct of the kids' dazed immersion in the virtual world. Alas, they were about to learn the web belonged to grown-ups. I was already thinking of the subpoena deuces tecum, the order to produce documents and records, that I would send to Facebook to preserve all these online conversations. In the meantime, avid as an eavesdropper, I went on reading. Dylan Feldman, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 9:07 p.m. on April 15, 2007,
Jacob, shut the fuck up. If you don't want to read it, go someplace else. You of all people. Fuck off. He considered you a friend, dickhead.
Mike Kanan, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 9:01 p.m. on April 15, 2007,
have to call you out on that, Jake. You're not the FBI police, especially the way things went down. You should keep your head down and be quiet.
John Marola, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 8:51 p.m. on April 15, 2007.
What the fuck? JB, what are you mouthing off here for? Go die. The world would be a better place. Go fuck off and die.
Julie Kirshner, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 8:48 p.m. on April 15, 2007.
Not cool, Jacob.
Jacob Barber, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 7:30 p.m. on April 15, 2007.
Maybe you all haven't heard. Ben is dead. Why are we still writing him messages? And why are some people acting like his best friend when you never were? Can we just be real here?
I stopped at Jacob's name, at the realization that these last venomous messages were aimed at my Jacob. I was not prepared for the reality of Jacob's life, the complexity of his relationships, the trials he went through, the brutality of the world he inhabited. Go die. The world would be a better place. How could my son have been told such a thing and never shared it with his family? Never even let on. I was disappointed not in Jacob, but in myself. How could I have left my son with the impression I did not care about such things? Or was I being a wimp, overreacting to the exaggerated, hopped-up tone of the Internet? I also felt like a fool, honestly. I ought to have known about all this. Lori and I had talked with Jacob only in the most general way about what he did on the Internet. We knew that when he went off to his room at night, he was able to go online, but we
We had some software installed on his computer to prevent him from looking at certain websites, porn sites mostly, and we felt that was enough. Facebook never seemed particularly dangerous, certainly. Also, neither of us wanted to spy on him. As a couple, you believe that you raise a child with good values and then you give him space. You trust him to behave responsibly, at least until he gives you reason not to. Modern, enlightened parents, we had not wanted to be Jacob's adversaries, quizzing him about every move, hectoring him. It was a philosophy shared by most of the McCormick parents. What choice did we have? No parent can monitor his kids every moment, online or off. In the end, every child leads his own life, largely out of his parents' sight. Still, when I saw the words, "Go die," I realized how naive and stupid we had been. Jacob did not need our trust or our respect as much as he needed our protection, and that we had not given him. I scrolled through the messages more quickly. There were hundreds, each just a line or two. I could not possibly read them all, and I had no idea what Sarah Grohl wanted me to find. Jacob disappeared from the conversation for a long stretch as the messages got older. The kids consoled one another in maudlin messages. "We will never, ever be the same," and hard-boiled ones, "die young, stay pretty." Over and over they expressed their shock. The girls protested their love and loyalty, the boys their anger. I scoured these endless, repetitive messages for some worthwhile detail. "I can't believe this. We have to stick together. There are cops everywhere in school." Finally, I clicked over to Jacob's own Facebook page, where a hotter conversation was still simmering, this one from the immediate aftermath of the murder. Again, the messages were displayed in reverse chronological order. Marley Kunitz, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 3:29 p.m. on April 15, 2007, "D.Y., do not say things like that here. That is gossip, and it could get people hurt. Even if it's a joke, it's stupid. Jake, just ignore him." Joe O'Connor, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 3:16 p.m. on April 15, 2007, "Everyone should all just keep their mouths shut if we don't know what we're talking about. That means you, Derek, you tool. This is serious shit here. No fucking way you should be talking out of your ass like that." Mark Spicer, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 3:07 p.m. on April 15, 2007, "Anybody could say anything about anybody. Maybe you have a knife, Derek? How does it feel when somebody starts a rumor about you?" Then this. Derek Yu, McCormick Middle School, wrote at 2:25 p.m. on April 15, 2007, "Jake, everyone knows you did it. You have a knife. I've seen it." I could not move, could not budge my eyes from the message. I stared at it until the letters broke down into pixels. Derek Yu was a friend of Jacob's, a good friend. He had been to our house 100 times. The two boys had been in kindergarten together. Derek was a good kid. "I've seen it." The next morning, I let Lori and Jacob both leave before me. I told them I had a meeting at the Newton police station and did not want to drive back and forth to Cambridge. When they were safely gone, I went up to Jacob's room and searched. The search did not take long. In the top drawer of the bureau, I found something hard, lazily hidden in an old white T-shirt. I unrolled the T-shirt until it spilled onto the bureau a folding knife with a black rubberized handle. I picked it up daintily, tweezed the blade between my thumb and index finger, and pulled it open. "Oh, my God," I murmured. It might have been a military knife or a hunting knife, but then it seemed too small for that. Unfolded, it was about 10 inches long. The handle was black, grippy, shaped to accept 4 fingers. The blade was hook-shaped, with an intricately serrated cutting edge, a ripping blade, and it came to a lethal gothic point. The flat sides of the blade had been drilled out, presumably to save weight. The knife was sinister and beautiful, the shape of the blade, its curve and taper. It was like one of those lovely, deadly things in nature. A lick of flame, or the claw of an enormous cat. Chapter 6. Descent. 1 year later.
Transcript of grand jury investigation. Mr. LeJudas. When you discovered the knife, what did you do? I presume you reported it immediately.
Witness. No, I did not.
Mr. LeJudas. No? You discovered the murder weapon in an ongoing murder investigation and you did not tell anyone?
Why not?
You made such a pretty speech earlier this morning about how you believed in the system.
Witness. I did not report it because I did not believe that it was the murder weapon. I certainly did not know it for a fact.
Mr. LeJudas. You didn't know it for a fact?
Well, how could you? You kept it hidden. You didn't submit the knife for forensic testing, for blood, fingerprints, comparison with the wound, and so forth?
That would be the ordinary procedure, wouldn't it?
Witness. It would be if you genuinely suspected it was the weapon.
Mr. LeJudas.
Ah, so you didn't even suspect it was the weapon?
Witness. No.
Mr. LeJudas.
The thought never crossed your mind.
Witness. This was my son. A father does not think, can't even imagine, his child in those terms.
Mr. LeJudas.
Really? Can't even imagine it?
Witness. That's right.
Mr. LeJudas. The boy had no history of violence, no juvenile criminal record?
Witness. No, none.
Mr. LeJudas. No behavioral problems, no psychological problems?
Witness. No.
Mr. LeJudas. He had never heard a fly, is that fair to say?
Witness. Something like that.
Mr. LeJudas. And yet, when you found the knife, you covered it up. You behaved exactly as if you thought he was guilty.
Witness. That is not accurate.
Mr. LeJudas. Well, you didn't report it.
Witness. I was slow to realize.
In hindsight, I admit.
Mr. LeJudas.
Mr. Barber, how could you be slow to realize when, in fact, you'd been waiting for this moment for 14 years from the day your son was born?
The witness did not respond.
Mr. LeJudas,
you'd been waiting for this moment, fearing it, dreading it, but expecting it.
Witness, that's not true.
Mr. LeJudas, isn't it?
Mr. Barber, isn't it fair to say that violence runs in your family?
Witness, I object. That is a completely improper question.
Mr. LeJudas, your objection is noted for the record.
Witness, you are trying to mislead this jury. You are suggesting that Jacob could inherit a tendency to violence, as if violence were the same as red hair or hairy arms. That's wrong on the biology and wrong on the law. In a word, it's bullshit, and you know it.
Mr. LeJudas, but I'm not talking about biology at all. I'm talking about your state of mind, what you believed at the moment you found that knife.
Now, if you choose to believe in bullshit, that's your business. But what you believed is perfectly relevant and perfectly admissible as evidence, and you know it. But out of respect, I'll withdraw the question. We'll approach it another way. Have you ever heard the phrase, the murder gene?
Witness. Yes.
Mr. LeJudas. You've heard it where?
Witness. Just in conversation. I've used it in conversation with my wife. It's a figure of speech, nothing more.
Mr. LeJudas. A figure of speech.
Witness. It is not a scientific term. I'm not a scientist.
Mr. LeJudas. Of course. We're all non-experts here. Now, when you used this figure of speech, the murder gene, what were you referring to?
The witness did not respond.
Mr. LeJudas. Oh, come on, Andy. There's no reason to be shy about it. It's all a matter of public record now. You've felt a lot of anxiety, haven't you, in your life?
Witness. A long time ago, when I was a kid, not now.
Mr. LeJudas.
A long time ago, okay. You were worried a long time ago when you were a kid about your own history, your own family, weren't you?
The witness did not respond.
Mr. LeJudas.
It's fair to say you're descended from a long line of violent men, aren't you, Mr. Barber?
The witness did not respond.
Mr. LeJudas.
It's fair to say that, isn't it?
Witness, inaudible.
Mr. LeJudas,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. You're descended from a long line of violent men, aren't you?
Mr. Barber. Violence did run in my family. You could follow it like a red thread back through three generations. Probably there were more. Probably the red thread ran right the way back to Cain, but I never had any desire to trace it. A few stories, lurid, mostly unverifiable, and a few photographs had come down to me,
That was affliction enough. When I was a kid, I wanted to forget these stories entirely. I used to wonder what it would be like if a magical amnesia descended and erased my mind completely, leaving only a body and some sort of blank self, all potential, all soft clay. But of course, no matter how I tried to forget, the story of my ancestors was always stored in deep memory, always ready to poke up into awareness. I learned to manage with it. Later, for Jacob's sake, I learned to drink it down entirely, leaving nothing for anyone to see, nothing to share. Lori was a great believer in sharing, in the talking cure, but I never meant to cure myself. I never believed such a thing was possible. That is what Lori never understood. She knew that my father's ghost troubled me, but not why. She presumed the issue was that I never knew him and there would forever be a daddy-shaped hole in my life. I never told her anything else, though she tried to pry me open like an oyster. Lori's own dad was a shrink, and before Jacob was born, she was a teacher at the Gavin Middle School in South Boston, 5th and 6th grade English. She believed, based on these experiences, that she had some understanding of underfathered young boys. "You'll never be able to deal with it," she would tell me, "if you won't talk about it." "Oh, Lori, you never got it. I never intended to deal with it. I intended to stop it cold. I meant to stop the whole sordid criminal line of descent by absorbing it all inside me. I would stand there and stop it like a bullet. I would simply refuse to pass it along to Jake." So I chose not to learn much, not to research my history or analyze it for causes and effects. I purposely orphaned myself from the whole brawling lot of them. As far as I knew, as far as I chose to know, the red thread went back to my great-grandfather, a slit-eyed thug named James Burkett, who came east from North Dakota carrying in his bones some feral, wicked instinct for violence that would manifest itself over and over, in Burkett himself, in his son, and most spectacularly, in his grandson, my father. James Burkett was born near Minot, North Dakota, sometime around 1890. The circumstances of his childhood, his parents, whether he had any education, I knew nothing about these things, only that he grew up on the high plains of Dakota in the years after Little Bighorn, at the closing of the frontier. The first real evidence I had of the man was a sepia photograph on thick cardstock, taken in New York City at the H.W. Harrison Photographic Studio on Fulton Street on Wednesday, August 23, 1911. The day and date were carefully noted in pencil on the back of the photo, along with his new name, James Barber. The story behind this journey was also murky. The way I heard it, from my mother, who got it from my father's father, was that Burkett lit out of North Dakota to escape an armed robbery charge. He lay low a while on the south shore of Lake Superior, clamming and working on fishing boats, then made his way to New York under a new name. Why he changed his name, whether it was to avoid an arrest warrant or just to make a new start with a new identity out east or for some other reason, no one knew for sure. Nor could anyone explain why my great-grandfather chose Barber as his new surname. The only solid evidence I had of this period was the photo itself. It was the only image of James Burkett Barber I ever saw. He would have been about 20 or 21 when it was taken. He is shown full figure, slim and taut, bandy-legged in a borrowed coat with a bowler held in the crook of his arm. He squints into the camera with a bowery smirk, one corner of his mouth curling up like smoke. I surmised that the charge in North Dakota was probably more serious than armed robbery. Not only did Burkett Barber go to great lengths to escape it, a low-rent stick-up man on the lam did not have to travel so far or transform himself so completely, but upon arriving in New York he displayed an aptitude for violence almost immediately. There was no apprenticeship. He did not work his way up from petty assaults, as novice criminals do. He stepped on stage a hoodlum in full flower. His criminal record in New York included arrests for ABDW, assault with intent to rob, assault with intent to murder, mayhem, possession of an infernal device, possession of an unlicensed firearm, rape, and attempted murder. Between his first arrest in New York State in 1912 and his death in 1941, James Barber spent nearly half his days in prison or in custody awaiting trial. On two charges of rape and attempted murder alone, He served 14 years combined. It was the record of a professional criminal, and the one description of him that surfaced in the casebooks bore that out. The case was an attempted murder in 1916. It generated a perfunctory appeal and was therefore written up in the New York case reports in 1918. The summary of the facts of the case, as reported by Judge Barton in his decision, is just a few sentences long. The defendant became embroiled in an argument with the victim, a man named Peyton, at a Brooklyn bar. The argument had to do with a debt Peyton owed either to the defendant himself, according to the defendant, or to another for whom the defendant worked as a stalker or debt collector, according to the state. In the course of this argument, the defendant, in a transport of rage, attacked the victim with a bottle. He persisted in the attack even after the bottle had broken, after the affray had spilled from the bar out onto the street, and after the victim's left eye was badly damaged and his left ear shorn nearly off. The attack finally ended when several bystanders, to whom the victim was known, intervened to overwhelm the defendant and hold him forcibly with great effort until police arrived. One other detail from that court decision stood out. The judge noted, the defendant's reputation for violence was well known to Peyton, as indeed it was well known generally. James Barber left at least one son, my grandfather Russell, who was called Rusty. Rusty Barber lived until 1971. I knew him only briefly when I was a very little kid. Most of what I know about him comes from stories he told my mother, who later passed them on to me. Rusty never met his father and therefore never missed him. Didn't waste a hell of a lot of thought on him. Rusty was raised in Meriden, Connecticut, where his mother had people and where she returned from New York City, pregnant, to raise him up. She told the boy about his father, including his crimes. She did not mince words, but neither she nor the boy made a big deal about it or felt especially burdened. Lots of folks had it worse in those days. It did not occur to anyone that Rusty's father might affect the boy's future in any way. On the contrary, Rusty was raised with essentially the same expectations his neighbors were. He was a mediocre student and a little wild, but he did graduate from Meriden High School. He entered West Point in 1933, but left after his plebe year, much of which he spent in special confinement and walking disciplinary tours. He came back to Meriden, worked odd jobs, drifted. He married a local girl, my grandmother, and 7 months later had a son, whom he called William. Once, Rusty was involved in a minor scuffle and wound up getting arrested for assaulting a police officer, though he had not done any such thing, really. Just did not like the way the man laid hands on him. It was the war that turned things around for Rusty Barber. He joined the army as a private and took part in the D-Day invasion with the 1st Infantry Division. By the time the war was over, he was a lieutenant in the 3rd Army, a winner of the Medal of Honor and 2 Silver Stars, and a certified hero. During the battle for Nuremberg in April 1945, he single-handedly stormed a German machine gun emplacement, killing 6 Germans, the last 2 using his bayonet. There was a parade for him back in Meriden. He rode on the back of an open convertible and waved to the girls. After the war, he had 2 more kids, bought his own little wood frame house in Meriden. But he was not nearly as well suited to peacetime. He flopped in a series of businesses, insurance, real estate, a restaurant. He did finally find a place as a traveling salesman. He repped a number of clothing and shoe lines, and he spent most of his working life driving around southern New England with boxes of samples in his car trunk, which he displayed to storekeepers in one cramped office after another. Looking back on this period in my grandfather's life, he must have been laboring mightily to stay straight. Rusty Barber had his father's genius for violence, which the war encouraged and rewarded, but he was not exceptionally talented in any other respect. Still, he might have made it. He might have got through life peacefully in a left-handed way, but it was a precarious thing, and events conspired against him. On May 11, 1950, he was in Lowell, Massachusetts, calling on Burke's Clothing Store to show the new line of Mighty Mac parkas for the fall. He stopped for lunch at a hot dog place he liked called Elliot's. As he left Elliot's, there was an accident. A car swiped the front of Rusty's Buick Special as he crept out of the parking lot. There was an argument, a shove. The other man produced a knife. When it was over, the man lay on the street, and Rusty walked away as if nothing had happened.
The man stood up with his hands pressed to his belly. Blood seeped through his fingers. He opened his shirt but held his hands over his stomach a moment as if he had a bellyache. When the man finally pulled his hands away, a slick coiled snake of intestines drooped out of him. A vertical incision split his stomach from the pelvis to the bottom of the chest bone. With his own hands, the man lifted his intestines back into his own body, held them there, and walked inside to call the police. They threw the book at Rusty. Assault with intent to murder, mayhem, ABDW. At trial, he argued self-defense, but he confessed, fatally, that he did not recall any of the things he was accused of, including taking the man's knife and gutting him with it. His memory failed at the moment the man came at him with the knife. He was sentenced to 7 to 10 years. He served 3. By the time he got back to Meriden, his eldest son, William, my father, Billy Barber, was 18 and already too wild for any father to control, even one as formidable as Rusty. And here we reach the part of the story where the fabric frays and runs out. For I have no real memories of my own father back then, just fragments. An unfocused blue-green tattoo on the inside of his right wrist, in the shape of a cross or a dagger, which he picked up in prison somewhere. His hands, pale, red-knuckled, bony talons, quite credible as instruments of murder. His mouth full of long yellow teeth. A curved, pearl-handled knife, which he always carried at his belt at the small of his back, tucked there every morning automatically, the way other men slipped a wallet into a back pocket. Beyond these glimpses, though, I just cannot remember him. And even these scraps I don't really trust. I've had years to embellish them. It was 1961 when I last saw my father. I was 5, he was 26. For a long time, as a little kid, I tried to preserve my memories of him to keep him from disappearing. That was before I really understood what he was. Over the years, he dematerialized anyway. By the time I was 10 or so, I had no real memory of him except these few stray puzzle pieces. A little while after that, I quit thinking of him altogether. For convenience, I lived as if I had no father, as if I had come into the world unfathered, and this attitude I never questioned because nothing any good could ever come of it. One memory did stick, if imperfectly. Sometime in that last summer, 1961, my mom took me to visit him in the Whaley Avenue jail in New Haven. We sat at one end of the pitted wood tables in the crowded visiting room. The prisoners in their boxy prison dungarees and pajama tops all looked like the crayon drawings of flat, square-shaped men that my friends and I used to draw. I must have been shy that day. You had to be careful around him, because my father had to coax me. "Come here, let me look at you." He clamped his fist around my tiny upper arm and drew me forward. "Come here, you come all this way to visit? Get over here." Years later, I can still feel his grip on my arm, twisting it slightly, the way you would twist a chicken leg to tear it away. He had done a terrible thing. I knew that. No adult would tell me what it was exactly. It involved a girl and one of the empty boarded-up row houses on Congress Avenue, and the pearl-handled knife. That was the part that made grown-ups go quiet. My childhood ended that summer. I learned the word murder. But it is not enough to be told a word as big as that. You have to live with it, carry it around with you. You have to pace around and around it, see it from different angles, at different times of day, in different light, until you understand, until it enters you. You have to hold it inside yourself in secret for years, like the hideous stone inside a peach. How much of this did Lori know? None of it. I knew the moment I laid eyes on her that she was a nice Jewish girl from a nice Jewish family, and she would not consider me if she knew the truth. So I told her in vague and romantic terms that my father had a raffish reputation, but I had never known him. I was the product of a short, unhappy love affair. For the next 35 years, that was how things stood. To Lori, I was essentially fatherless. I never told her any different because in my own mind I was essentially fatherless. Certainly I was not bloody Billy Barber's son. There was nothing very dramatic in all this. When I told my girlfriend, who became my wife, that I did not know who my father was, I was simply saying out loud what I had been repeating to myself for years. I was not misleading her at all. If I had once been Billy Barber's son, by the time I met Lori, I had long ceased to be, except in strict biological terms. What I told Lori was nearer the truth than the actual facts were. You will say, okay, but surely in all those years there must have come a time when you could have told her. But the truth is, as time went by, what I had told Lori became more and more true. As a grown man, I was even less Billy's boy. It was all just a story, some old myth that had nothing to do with who I actually was. I did not even think about it much, honestly. At some point, as adults, we cease to be our parents' children, and we become our children's parents instead. What was more, I had the girl. I had Lori, and we were happy. Our marriage settled into a rhythm. We believed we knew each other, and we were each happy with our conception of our partner. Why spoil that? Why risk the rare happy marriage, rarer still, a love marriage that endures, for something as common and as toxic as complete, unthinking, transparent honesty? Who would be helped by my telling? Me? Not at all. I was made of steel, I promise you. There is a more mundane explanation, too. It just never came up. It turns out there is no good time in the average day to announce to your wife that you are the son of a murderer. Chapter 7. Denial. LeJudas was half right. By this point, I did suspect Jacob, but not of murder. The scenario LeJudas was trying to sell to the grand jury, that because of my family history and because of the knife, I immediately knew Jacob was a psychopath and covered for him, was pure bullshit. I don't blame LeJudas for overselling the case that way. Juries are hard of hearing by nature, the more so in this case where circumstances essentially forced them to stick their fingers in their ears. LeJudas had no choice but to shout. But the fact is, nothing so dramatic had happened. The suggestion that Jacob might be a murderer was just crazy. I did not seriously consider it. What I thought, rather, was that something was up. Jacob knew more than he was telling. Lord knows that was unsettling enough. Suspicion, once it started to corkscrew itself into my thoughts, made me experience everything twice, as questioning prosecutor and as anxious father, one after the truth, the other terrified of it. And if I did not exactly confess all that to the grand jury, well, I knew enough to oversell my case, too. The day I discovered the knife, Jacob got home from school around 2:30. From the kitchen, Lori and I listened to him clatter into the front hall and back-heel the door shut, then slip off his backpack and coat in the mudroom. We exchanged nervous glances as, like sonar operators, we interpreted these sounds. "Jacob," Lori called, "can you come in here, please?" There was a moment's stillness, a catch, before he said, "Okay." Lori made a positive face to reassure me. Jacob shambled into the kitchen apprehensively. From my perspective, looking up at him, it struck me how big he had gotten, this man-sized boy. "Dad, what are you doing home?" "There's something we need to talk about, Jake." He came in a little farther and saw the knife on the table between us. With the blade folded into the handle, the knife had lost its menace. It was just a tool. I said, in as neutral a tone as I could manage, "You want to tell us what this is?" "A knife?" "Don't fool around, Jacob." "Sit down, Jacob," his mother encouraged. "Sit down." He sat. "You looked through my room?" "I did, not your mother." "You searched it?" "Yep." "Ever heard of privacy?" "Jacob," Lori said, "your father was worried about you." He rolled his eyes. Lori continued, "We're both worried. Why don't you just tell us what this is all about?" "Jacob, you put me in a difficult position, you know. Half the state police are looking for this knife." "For this knife?" "Not this knife, a knife. You know what I mean. For a knife like this. I just don't understand what a kid like you is doing with a knife like this. Why do you need it, Jake?" "I don't need it. It's just something I got." "Why?" "I don't know." "You got it, but you don't know why?" "It's just, I don't know, something I did. For no reason. It doesn't mean anything. Why does everything have to mean something?" "Then why did you hide it?" "Probably because I knew you'd freak out." "Well, you got that right, at least. Why do you need a knife?" "I just told you I don't need it. I just thought it was kind of cool. I liked it. I just wanted it." Are you having problems with other kids?
No.
Is there someone you're afraid of?
No. Like I said, I just saw it and I thought it was cool, so I bought it.
He shrugged.
Where?
This Army-Navy store in town. They're not hard to find.
Is there a record of the sale? Did you use a credit card?
No, cash.
My eyes narrowed.
It's not that unusual. Jesus, Dad, people do use cash, you know.
What do you do with it?
Nothing. I just look at it, hold it, see how it feels.
You carry it with you?
No, not usually.
But sometimes?
No, well, rarely.
Do you bring it to school?
No, except once. I showed it to some kids.
Who?
Derek, Dylan, couple others maybe.
Why?
'Cause I thought it was cool. It was like, hey, check this out.
Have you ever used it for anything?
Like what?
I don't know, whatever you'd use a knife for, to cut.
You mean, have I ever stabbed anyone with it in Cold Spring Park?
No, I mean, have you ever used it at all?
No, never, of course not.
So you just got it and stuck it in your drawer?
Pretty much, yeah.
That doesn't make sense.
Well, it's the truth.
Why would you, Andy? His mother cut in.
He's a teenager, that's why.
Lori, he doesn't need help.
Lori explained, teenagers do stupid things sometimes.
She turned to Jacob.
Even smart teenagers do stupid things.
Jacob, I need to ask you, for my own peace of mind, is this the knife they're looking for?
No, are you crazy?
Do you know anything about what happened to Ben Rifkin? Anything you heard from your friends? Anything at all you can tell me?
No, of course not.
He looked at me evenly, meeting my gaze with his own. It only lasted a moment, but it was unmistakably a challenge, the sort of eye-fuck a defiant witness will flip you on the stand. Once he had outfaced me, his point made, he became a petulant kid again.
I can't believe you're asking me this stuff, Dad. It's like I get home from school and suddenly I get all these questions. I just can't believe this. I can't believe you actually think these things about me.
I don't think anything about you, Jacob. All I know is you brought that knife into my house and I'd like to know why.
Who told you to look for it?
Never mind who told me.
One of the kids at school, obviously. Someone you interviewed yesterday. Just tell me who.
It doesn't matter who. This isn't about what other kids did. You're not the victim here.
Andy,
Lori warned. She had told me not to confront or cross-examine him, not to accuse.
Just talk to him, Andy. This is a family. We talk to each other.
I looked away. Deep breath.
Jacob, if I submit that knife for testing, for blood or any other evidence, would you object?
No. Go ahead, do whatever tests you want. I don't care. I considered for a moment.
Okay. I believe you. I believe you.
Do I get my knife back?
Absolutely not.
It's my knife. You have no right to take it.
I'm your father. That gives me the right.
You're also with the cops.
Are you worried about the cops for some reason, Jake?
No.
Then what are you talking about your rights for?
What if I don't let you take it?
Try.
He stood there looking at the knife on the table and at me, weighing the risk and reward.
This is so wrong, he said, and he frowned at the injustice.
Jake, your father's just doing what he thinks is best because he loves you.
What about what I think is best? That doesn't matter, I suppose.
No, I said. It doesn't. By the time I got to the Newton police station that same afternoon, they had Pats in the interview room, where he sat as still as an Easter Island head, staring into a camera that was hidden in the face of a schoolhouse clock. Pats knew the camera was there. The detectives were required to inform him and get his consent to record the interview. The camera was hidden away in the hope that suspects would stop thinking about it. Pats's image was piped to a small computer screen in the detective bureau, right outside the interview room, where a half-dozen Newton and CPAC detectives stood watching. So far, it had not been much of a show, apparently. The cops wore flat expressions, not seeing much, not expecting to see much. I came into the detective bureau and joined them.
He say anything?
Nothing,
He's Sergeant Schultz. On screen, Pat's image filled the frame. He sat at the head of a long wood table. Behind him was a bare white wall. Pat's was a big man. According to his probation officer, he was 6'3" and 260 pounds. Even seated behind a table, he looked massive. But his body was soft. His sides, belly, and tits all sagged against his black polo shirt, as if he had been poured and bagged up inside this black sack cinched shut at the neck. "Jesus," I said, "this guy could use a little exercise." One of the CPAC guys said, "How about jerking off to kiddie porn?" We all sniggered. In the interview room, on one side of Pat's was Paul Duffy from CPAC, on the other a Newton detective, Nils Peterson. The cops were visible on screen only now and then, when they leaned forward into the camera frame. Duffy was leading the Q&A. "Okay, take me through it one more time. Tell me what you remember from that morning." "I already told you. One more time. You'd be surprised the things that come back to people when they go back over the story." "I don't want to talk anymore. I'm getting tired." "Hey, Lenny, do yourself a favor, all right? I'm trying to exclude you here. I already told you I'm trying to rule you out. This is in your interest." "It's Leonard. A witness puts you in Cold Spring Park that morning." That was a fib. On screen, Duffy said, "You know I have to check that out. With your record, that's just the way it is. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't." Pat's sighed. "Just one more time, Lenny. I don't want to get the wrong guy." "It's Leonard." He rubbed his eyes. "All right. I was in the park. I walk there every morning, but I was nowhere near where the kid got killed. I never go that way. I never walk in that part. I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything." He began to count these points on his fingers. "I don't know the kid. I never saw the kid. I never heard of the kid." "All right, calm down, Lenny." "I am calm." A glance into the camera. "And you didn't see anyone that morning?" "No." "No one saw you leave your apartment or come back?" "How should I know?" "You didn't see anyone in the park who looked suspicious, anyone who didn't belong there, who we should know about?" "No." "All right, let's take a quick break, okay? You stay here. We'll be back in a few minutes. We'll just have a few more questions and then that'll be it." "What about my lawyer?" "Haven't heard from him yet." "You'll tell me when he gets here?" "Sure, Lenny." The two detectives got up to leave. "I never hurt anyone," Pat said. "You remember that. I never hurt anyone, ever." "Okay," Duffy reassured him. "I believe you." The detectives crossed in front of the camera and stepped through the door directly into the room where they had been only distant images in the computer monitor. Duffy shook his head. "I've got nothing. He's used to dealing with cops. I just don't have anything to challenge him with. I'd like to let him sit there a while and cool off, but I don't think we'll have time. His lawyer's on the way. What do you want to do, Andy?" "You've been going like this for how long?" "A couple hours, maybe, something like that." "Just like this? Deny, deny, deny?" "Yeah, it's useless." "Do it again." "Do it again? Are you kidding? How long have you been watching?" "I just got here, Duff, but what else can we do? He's our only real suspect. A little boy is dead. This guy likes little boys. He's already given you the fact he was in the park that morning. He knows the area. He's there every morning, so he knows the routine. He knows kids walk through those woods every morning. He's certainly big enough to overpower the victim. That's motive, means, and opportunity. So I say stay with it till he gives you something." Duffy's eyes flicked to the other cops in the room, then back to me. "His lawyer's about to shut it down anyway, Andy." "Then there's no time to waste, is there? Get back in there. Get me a confession and I'll take it to the grand jury this afternoon." "Just get you a confession, just like that." "That's why you get the big bucks, pal." "What about the kids at the school? I thought that's where we were headed." "We'll keep looking at it, Duff, but what do we have, really? A bunch of freaked-out kids running their mouths on Facebook? So what? Look at this guy. Just look at him. Name me a better suspect. We don't have one." "You really believe that, Andy? This is the guy, you think?" "Yes, maybe. Maybe. But we need something real to prove it. Get me a confession, Duff. Get me the knife. Get me anything. We need something." "Okay, then." Duffy looked resolutely at the Newton detective who was his partner on this case. "We do it again, like the man says." The cop hesitated, appealing to Duffy with his eyes. "Why waste time?" "We do it again," Duffy repeated. "Like the man says."
Mr. LeJudas. They never got the chance, did they? The detectives never got back into the interrogation room with Leonard Patz that day.
Witness. No, they did not. Not that day or any other day.
Mr. LeJudas. How did you feel about that?
Witness. I thought it was a mistake. Based on what we knew at the time, it was a mistake to turn away from Patz as a suspect so early in the investigation. He was our best suspect by far.
Mr. LeJudas.
You still believe that?
Witness. Without a doubt, we should have stayed on Patz.
Mr. LeJudas. Why?
Witness. Because that's where the evidence was pointing.
Mr. LeJudas. Not all the evidence.
Witness. All? You never have all the evidence pointing in one direction. Not in a tough case like this one. That's precisely the problem.
You don't have enough information. The data is incomplete. There is no clear pattern, no obvious answer. So detectives do what all people do. They form a narrative in their head, a theory, and then they go looking in the data for evidence to support it. They pick a suspect first, then they look for the evidence to convict him. And they stop noticing evidence that points at other suspects.
Mr. LeJudas.
Like Leonard Patz.
Witness. Like Leonard Patz.
Mr. LeJudas. Are you suggesting that's what happened here?
Witness.
I'm suggesting mistakes were made, yes, certainly.
Mr. LeJudas.
So what is a detective supposed to do in this situation?
Witness.
He has to be wary of locking onto one suspect too soon, because if he guesses wrong, he will miss evidence pointing him toward the right answer. He'll miss even obvious things.
Mr. LeJudas.
But a detective has to form theories. He has to focus on suspects, usually before he has clear evidence against them. What else can he do?
Witness.
That's the dilemma. You always start with a guess. And sometimes you guess wrong.
Mr. LeJudas.
Did anyone guess wrong in this case?
Witness.
We don't know. We just don't know.
Mr. LeJudas.
All right, go on with your story. Why didn't the detectives go on interrogating Patz?
An older man with a battered lawyer's bag came into the detective bureau. His name was Jonathan Klein. He was short, slight, a little stooped. He wore a gray suit with a black turtleneck. His hair was long and strikingly white. He swept it straight back over his head where it hung over the back of his collar. He had a white goatee as well. He said in a soft voice, "Hello, Andy."
"Jonathan."
We shook hands with real warmth. I always liked and respected Jonathan Klein. Bookish and vaguely bohemian, he was unlike me. I am as conventional as white toast. But he did not lecture or lie, which set him apart from his brethren in the defense bar, who had only a casual regard for the truth, and he was genuinely smart and knew the law. He was, there is no other word for it, wise. Also, it must be said, I had a childish attraction to men of my father's generation, as if I still harbored a faint hope of being unorphaned, even at this late date. Klein said, "I'd like to see my client now." His voice was soft. It was naturally soft. This was not an affectation or a tactic, so that the room tended to grow quiet around him. You found yourself leaning in close to make out what he was saying.
"I didn't know you were representing this guy, Jonathan. Kind of a low-rent case for you, isn't it? Some crummy pedophile ball-grabber? It's bad for your reputation."
"Reputation? We're lawyers."
"Anyway, he's not here because he's a pedophile. We both know that. This is a lot of cops to put on a case about ball-grabbing." I stepped aside.
"All right. He's right in there. Go on in."
"You'll turn off the camera and the microphone?"
"Yeah. You want to use another room instead?"
"No, of course not."
He smiled gently.
"I trust you, Andy."
"Enough to let your man keep talking?"
"No, no, I trust you too much for that."
And that was the end of Patz's Q&A. 9:30 p.m. Lori lay on the couch gazing at me, her book tented on her belly. She wore a brown V-neck shirt with a wreath of chunky embroidery around the neck, and her tortoiseshell reading glasses.
Over the years, she had found a way to carry her younger style into middle age. She had upgraded the embroidered peasant blouses and ripped jeans of her brainy funkster teens for a more elegant, tailored version of the same look. She said, "Do you want to talk about it?"
"Talk about what?"
"Jacob."
"We already did."
"I know, but you're brooding."
"I'm not brooding. I'm watching TV."
"The Cooking Channel?"
She smiled, warmly skeptical.
"There's nothing else on. Anyway, I like cooking."
"No, you don't. I like watching cooking."
"It's okay, Andy. You don't have to if you're not ready."
"It's not that. It's just there's nothing to say."
"Can I ask you one question?"
I rolled my eyes. "Does it matter if I say no?"
She picked up the remote from the coffee table and switched off the TV. "When we talked to Jacob today, you said you didn't think he did anything. But then you turned around and cross-examined him."
"No, I didn't."
"You did. You never accused him of anything exactly, but your tone was prosecutorial."
"It was?"
"A little."
"I didn't mean for it to be. I'll apologize to him later."
"You don't have to apologize."
"I do, if that's how I came off."
"I'm just asking why. Is there anything you're not telling me?"
"Like what?"
"Whatever made you go after him that way?"
"I didn't go after him. Anyway, no, I was just upset about the knife and what Derek wrote on Facebook."
"Because Jacob's had some behavioral—"
"Jesus, Lori, come on, be serious. This is just some kids gossiping. If I could get my hands on Derek, that was incredibly stupid what he wrote. Honestly, sometimes I think that kid isn't all there."
"Derek's not a bad kid."
"Will you still say that when Jacob gets a knock on the door one day?"
"Is that a real possibility?"
"No, of course not."
"Do we have any responsibility here?"
"You mean, is it our fault somehow?"
"Fault? No. I mean, do we have to report it?"
"No, God, no. There's nothing to report. It's not a crime to have a knife. It's not a crime to be a stupid teenager either, thank God, or we'd have to throw half of them in the can."
Lori nodded neutrally. "It's just, he's been accused, and now you know about it. And it's not like the cops aren't going to find it anyway. It's right there on Facebook."
"It's not a credible accusation, Lori. There's no reason to bring the whole world down on Jake's head. The whole thing is ridiculous."
"Is that what you really think, Andy?"
"Yes, of course. Don't you?"
She searched my face. "Okay, so this isn't what's bothering you?"
"I already told you, nothing's bothering me."
"Really?"
"Really."
"What did you do with the knife?"
"I got rid of it."
"Got rid of it where?"
"I threw it away, not here, in a dumpster somewhere."
"You covered for him."
"No, I just wanted that knife out of my house. And I don't want anyone using it to make Jacob look guilty when he's not, that's all."
"How is that different from covering for him?"
"You can't cover for someone who didn't do anything wrong." She gave me a searching look.
"Okay, I'm going up to bed. You coming?"
"In a little while." She got up, came over to plow her fingers through my hair and kiss my forehead.
"Don't stay up too late, sweetheart. You won't be able to get up in the morning."
"Lori, you didn't answer my question. I asked you what you think. Do you agree it's ridiculous to think Jacob did this?"
"I think it's very hard to imagine, yes."
"But you can imagine it?"
"I don't know."
"You mean you can't, Andy? You can't even imagine it?"
"No, I can't. This is our son we're talking about."
She pulled back from me visibly, cautiously.
"I don't know. I guess I can't imagine it either. But then I think, when I woke up this morning, I could not have imagined that knife."
Chapter 8. The End. Sunday, April 22, 2007, 10 days after the murder. On a raw, drizzly morning, hundreds of volunteers turned out to sweep Cold Spring Park for the missing knife. They were a cross-section of the town, kids from the McCormick, some who had been friends with Ben Rifkin, some who were clearly from other school tribes, jocks, geeks, kittenish good girls. There were lots of young mothers and fathers, a few of the activist mockers who were constantly organizing community efforts of one kind or another.
All these assembled in the morning damp, listened to instructions from Paul Duffy about how the search would proceed. Then, in teams, they tromped off across the spongy wet ground to search their assigned quadrants of the woods for the knife. There was a determined mood to the whole adventure. It was a relief for everyone to do something, finally, to be admitted into the investigation. Soon, they were sure, the whole thing would be resolved. It was the waiting, the uncertainty that was wearing them down. The knife would end all that. It would bear fingerprints or blood or some other morsel that would unlock the mystery, and the town would finally be able to exhale. Mr. LeJudas, you didn't take part in the search, did you? Witness, no, I did not. Mr. LeJudas, because you knew it was a fool's errand. The knife they were looking for had already been found in Jacob's dresser drawer, and you had already dumped it for him. Witness, no, I knew that was not the knife they were looking for. There was no doubt in my mind, zero. Mr. LeJudas, then why didn't you join the search? Witness, a prosecutor never takes part in his own searches. I couldn't risk becoming a witness in my own case. Think about it. If I were the one to find the murder weapon, I'd have become an essential witness. I'd be forced to cross the courtroom and take the stand. I'd have to give up the case. That's why a good prosecutor always hangs back. He waits at the police station or out on the street while a search warrant is executed. He watches from the next room while a detective conducts an interrogation. That is Prosecution 101, Neil. It's standard procedure. It's exactly what I taught you once upon a time. Maybe you weren't listening. Mr. LeJudas, so it was for technical reasons? Witness, Neil, no one wanted the search to succeed as much as I did. I wanted my son to be proven innocent. Finding the real knife would have accomplished that. Mr. LeJudas, you're not the least bit troubled by the way you disposed of Jacob's knife, even now knowing what happened? Witness, I did what I thought was right. Jake was innocent. It was the wrong knife. Mr. LeJudas, of course you weren't willing to test that theory, were you? You didn't submit the knife for forensic testing, for fingerprints or blood or fiber traces, as you threatened Jacob you might. Witness, it was the wrong knife. I did not need a test to confirm that for me. Mr. LeJudas, you already knew. Witness, I already knew. Mr. LeJudas, what was it? What made you so sure? Witness, I knew my son. Mr. LeJudas, that's it? You knew your son? Witness, I did what any father would do. I tried to protect him from his own stupidity. Mr. LeJudas, okay, we'll leave it. All right, so while the others searched in Cold Spring Park that morning, you waited where? Witness, in the parking lot at the entrance to the park. Mr. LeJudas, and at some point Mr. Rifkin, the victim's father, appeared? Witness, yes. When I first saw him, he was coming from the direction of the woods. There are playing fields at the front of the park there, soccer fields, baseball. That morning the fields were empty. It was just a huge, flat, open, grassy expanse, and he was making his way across it toward me. This will always be my lasting image of Dan Rifkin alone in his misery, a small figure meandering across this massive green space, head bowed, arms thrust down into his coat pockets. The wind kept blustering him off course. He zigzagged like a little boat tacking up wind. I went out onto the fields to meet him, but we were some distance apart and the crossing took time. For an awkward interval, we watched each other approach. What must we have looked like from above? Two tiny forms inching across an empty green field toward a meeting somewhere in the center. As he drew close, I waved. But Rifkin did not return the gesture. Thinking he was upset by accidentally running across the search, I made a churlish note to ream out the victim advocate who had forgotten to warn Rifkin away from the park that day. "Hey, Dan," I said in a wary tone. He wore aviator sunglasses, though the weather was gray, and his eyes showed dimly through the lenses. He stared up at me, his eyes behind those lenses as huge and inexpressive as a fly's. Angry, apparently. "Are you okay, Dan? What are you doing here?" "I'm surprised to see you here." "Yeah, why is that? Where else would I be?" He snorted. "What is it, Dan?" "You know," his tone going philosophical, I've had the strangest feeling lately, like I'm on stage and all the people around me are actors. Everyone in the world, every single person rushing around me on the sidewalk, they march around with their noses up in the air pretending like nothing has happened. And I'm the only one who knows the truth. I'm the only one who knows everything has changed.
I nodded, benign, indulging him.
They're false. You know what I mean, Andy? They're pretending.
I can only imagine how you must feel, Dan.
I think maybe you're an actor, too.
Why do you say that?
I think you're false.
Rifkin took off his sunglasses, folded them carefully, and stowed them in an inside pocket of his jacket. The bags under his eyes had darkened since I saw him last. His olive skin had taken on a grayish pallor.
I hear you're being taken off the case.
What? You heard that from who?
Doesn't matter who. I just want you to know. I want another DA.
Okay, well, that's something we can talk about, certainly.
There's nothing to talk about. It's already done. Go call your boss. You need to talk to your own people. I told you, I want another DA, someone who won't just sit on the case. And that's going to happen now.
Sit on the case? Dan, what the hell are you talking about?
You said everything was being done.
What was being done, exactly?
Look, it's been a hard case, I acknowledge.
No, no, it's more than that, and you know it.
Why haven't you pressed those kids, still to this day? I mean, really put the screws to them. That's what I want to know.
I have talked to them.
Including your own kid, Andy?
My mouth fell open. I extended my hand toward him to touch his arm, to connect, but he raised his arm as if to backhand it away.
You've been lying to me, Andy. All along you've been lying.
He looked off toward the trees.
Do you know what bothers me, Andy, about being here in this place? It's that, for a while, for a few minutes, maybe just a few seconds, I don't know how long, but for some amount of time, my son was alive here. He was out there lying in some fucking wet leaves, bleeding to death. And I wasn't here with him. I was supposed to be here to help him. That's what a father does. But I didn't know. I was off somewhere, in the car, in my office, talking on the phone, whatever it was I was doing. Do you understand that, Andy? Do you have any idea how that feels? Can you even imagine it? I saw him get born. I saw him take his first steps and learn to ride a bike. I took him to his first day of school. But I wasn't here to help him when he died. Can you imagine how that feels?
Dan, I said weakly, why don't I get a cruiser down here to drive you home? I don't think it's good for you to be here.